This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking about crime, and we are speaking to a wonderful guest, Kerry Danes, who's at the forefront of her field in forensic psychology. I will come back to talking a little bit more about her shortly. And first, we've got some information to kind of get us into this theme, because it's something that we last talked about with Jan Canty. So today we're looking at this theme from quite a different angle, and instead in an effort to debunk much of this stigmatizing perception that those who experience mental illness have some innate criminality or risk of criminality about them. And ultimately, I think a lot of that comes down to this notion that purely by having experience of mental illness, you might be violent or scary or different in a way that is intimidating. And that's very concerning in terms of how that is a stigmatizing attitude, and obviously links to a lot of the terminology we hear of people being called crazy, for example, and obviously the films and reported media at times can perpetuate that idea of a big, scary, mentally ill person. And it's certainly very far from the truth for the vast majority of people, and certainly the people we talk to.
Wow, it's just such a biggie, isn't it, this one? It's such a wide-ranging topic. I was even listening to a group of girls talk the other day, young girls, about, in fact, it was at a sports tournament, and there was somebody on the other team who was obviously showing signs of being extremely anxious and really struggling in that moment. And people were like laughing, and some people were saying like, oh, she's so scary, because she was like, oh, you know, really frustrated, like when you squeeze your hands. I mean, the team were losing that she was on, but it was obviously struggling to cope. And the narrative even that came from these young girls, where especially when so often think now that mental illness and mental health is talked about much more in schools and there's much more awareness. Anytime I work with young people, I often think, wow, they're so much more open and their thinking is so much more progressive than people in my age group or generation. Yet they were still like, oh my God, she's so scary. Thought she was going to kill me. You know, really making comments like that. And some were then laughing and some weren't, you know. And I obviously had to do my bit, and when it had all calmed down and gone over and spoke to the person that I think was in charge of them, just to make sure that this kid was okay and whatever. And some subsequently did then hear that, you know, she does struggle with her mental health. And it really upset me to think that she's in that moment and nobody seemed to care, really. You know, her peers, they were fearful of her. And she, to me, she wasn't showing any signs of aggression. But, you know, it's just, you know, like you said, and things that we see in here, it kind of just perpetuates this scaremongering of people who might be struggling.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's why I particularly wanted to cover this theme, because that's where a lot of it seems to go, to that extreme, that someone's behaviour is different to ours, or we know that they experience mental ill health, and therefore some people take that as, oh, then they're dangerous, they're going to act in a way that is violent, I think is the extreme thinking that a lot of people go to. And so I found a paper actually that's been published specifically on that potential link, because I think that is where a lot of it goes to. And the paper's called Violence and Mental Illness, What is the True Story? And this was published in the British Medical Journal. And so I'll read a bit of this, because I think they phrase it very well, it reads quite paperish, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So if I stumble on words, that'll be why. In public perception, mental illness and violence remain inextricably intertwined, and much of the stigma associated with mental illness may be due to the tendency to conflate mental illness with the concept of dangerousness. This perception is further augmented by media, which sensationalises violent crimes committed by persons with mental illness, and focus on mental illness in such reports, ignoring the fact that most of violence in society is caused by people without mental illness. This societal bias contributes to the stigma faced by those with a psychiatric diagnosis, which in turn contributes to a non-disclosure of the mental illness and decreased treatment seeking, and also leads to discrimination against them. The association of violence and mental ill health has received extensive attention and publicity. Public perception of the association between mental illness and violence seems to have fueled the arguments for coerced treatment of patients with severe mental illness. However, this perception is not borne out by the research literature available on the subject. Instead, those with mental illness make up a small proportion of violent offenders, and a recent meta-analysis by Large et al. Found that in order to prevent one such incident, 35,000 patients with schizophrenia judged to be at high risk would need to be detained. This clearly contradicts a general belief that patients with severe mental illness are a threat to others.
I mean, that's a great piece. I'd love, really enjoy actually studying it more and getting into it, actually, because as you read, the public perception and even my perception and the scientific facts and the evidence that's being presented, you know, are probably at opposite ends of all different extremes. I actually said to you, didn't I, before this conversation, that I would have thought that most people who commit a serious violent crime have some sort of mental illness, although I know that most people with a severe mental illness do not commit serious violent crime. Does that make sense?
And I think it's something we can absolutely hold ourselves accountable for, because it can be an example of that internalized stigma that even if we don't believe to the extent we're maybe encouraged to with a lot of the sort of narratives that are around it and a lot of stigmatizing attitudes, you can find yourself being drawn a bit in that direction and thinking, okay, well, there probably are quite a few links, even if they're not as bad as, you know, the headlines might tell us. And then even researching for this, there's even less of that than I believed. And I didn't think I believed there was a huge amount of links in the first place. And so it's so interesting how we can all have our perceptions twisted in this way. And talking to Kerry was really brilliant, because she's someone that works as a forensic psychologist with a range of people, but including very serious offenders, including people who are going through criminal proceedings to find out essentially if they did it, and indeed victims of a whole range of crimes. And so she deals with some very serious, high profile cases, is really at the forefront of this industry here in the UK, and was able to give me an insight that just otherwise you don't have. You don't have the one-to-one interactions with people in the justice system from any side. It's a very kind of closed system. And I understand the reasons for that in terms of making sure everything's done right and there's not outside interference. But it's interesting to hear from her just debunking with personal examples this idea that there is a huge link. And instead, when we talk about this theme, the big link we should be focusing on is instead how much more likely people that experience mental illness are to be a victim of crime. You know, if we're looking for a link between crime and mental illness, that's the actual link. That's the one where the evidence is conclusive and clear. And so...
Absolutely. Can I just say one thing, actually? It just makes me think, and I've thought about this for quite some time, but even just doing this intro now, that when we work so hard to try and reduce stigma when it comes to mental illness. But when we're thinking about severe mental illness, actually, I think everybody needs to really take a look at themselves, as we have over this last 18 months with so many different issues around, you know, social injustices and discrimination and all of the things that everybody's had to really check themselves and think, actually, could I do a bit better when it comes to this? Do I have a bit of stigma surrounding this? Am I a little biased? Like, what is going on for me? Well, everybody, I think, should have. Not everybody has, we know that. But actually, even being in certain situations where we may come across somebody, or there might be somebody in our family or a member of the public or whatever that is obviously experiencing mental illness in maybe quite a severe way, how do we check that in ourselves? What do we do? Do we cross over the street? Do we laugh at people? Do we kind of call names? Do we just think, oh my God, weirdo, don't let him, don't make eye contact, don't, because he'll just start talking to us, don't do it. You know, how guilty are we all of being a little bit discriminating to people that we come across day to day in our world? And I think that's something that perhaps isn't at the forefront of the discussion around discrimination. And it's something that should be. We should be educated a lot more. We're speaking about mental illness in schools, in work. You know, people are writing to me. People are talking about, oh, it's everybody, you know, mental health everywhere, and having so many conversations about it. Same as race. It's as if people don't want to talk about it anymore. Okay, we've been there, done that. Let's shut the book on it. But actually, there's a whole area of mental illness that we don't still discuss and that we still discriminate against. And there's still a massive stigma against in our world, in our day-to-day lives, in society. And I think that is something that we really need to all check in at.
Yeah, for sure. And it is one of the funniest examples of modern stigma when someone turns around to me and says, you know, it's just everywhere now. Like, it's, you know, wherever you look, there's mental health this, mental health that. And I'm like, uh-huh. It was always there. Just now we're talking about it. It's not some great conspiracy. It's just being talked about more. And actually, it's not everywhere. Far from. It's just more than somebody might be used to of these conversations being had.
Especially in the corporate world. Yeah.
And so we'll wrap up then with some information from Mind, who published a report called At Risk Yet Dismissed. And that was looking into how so often those with mental health problems are at increased risk of being victims of crime and yet don't necessarily get that taken into account, or can be less likely to get the support they need as a victim or a repeat victim. Some of the most startling findings from that report show that people with mental health problems are 3 times more likely to be a victim of crime than the general population, 5 times more likely to be a victim of assault, and that rises to 10 times more if you look specifically at women in the statistics, and more likely to be a repeat victim and experience different types of crime. And so I think that's a good place to wrap up of where we look at this theme. There's the big link. There's the big concern and the thing that needs to change. And Kerry will go into so much more detail about this theme, about her experience of a lifetime of working in an industry that is fascinating, but we just don't really think about. It's shielded from us in many ways that make sense, but it's so important. And I'm so grateful that there are people out there like her that are doing this important work. And she's also just a great person to chat to because she's so sort of straight talking and easy to relate to, even when talking about really sensitive topics. So with that all said, we'll get into this episode with the brilliant Kerry Danes in a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
My name is Kerry Danes, and I'm a consultant forensic psychologist. And I think that my earliest experience of mental health and mental health-related difficulties was listening to my mum talk to various colleagues, because she was a mental health nurse. So lots of her friends were also mental health nurses. So I think that from an early age, I picked up little bits of conversation that they had. And I think that looking back at that, with no disrespect at all to my mum and her colleagues, but much of that conversation seems so very dated now, and is so far removed from what I would expect, or certainly what I would hope from mental health nurses now. Although my mum was very, very caring, very caring. That came through to me, and maybe that had an impact on the career choice I made.
And from that young age, did you have an idea of what was being said? How much did you understand about her work and who she worked with?
I didn't understand a great deal. I remember that she was assaulted at work, and I do remember that. She had a tooth almost knocked out. And I think that, like many people, I thought, oh, people with mental health problems must be very scary and very dangerous. But of course, that was one incident in years and years of her career. And obviously, it's one that would stand out, because as a child, you remember when that happens to your mum. And I remember hearing conversations where maybe difficult and challenging is the word, isn't it? Challenging patients were discussed, and there was a little bit of, well, are they ill or are they just being naughty? So I think that the whole mad or bad thing had crept into those conversations. And mad and bad certainly is a theme that still persists, particularly in forensic psychology.
And I know that's something that you really like to draw the distinction of, because so often we can live in these dangerous binaries. And we talk about it a lot on our show in terms of this idea of, with mental illness, you're either ill or you're well, that black and white. And of course, we know working in it, that's not the case. But I think that can also exist with criminality as well. And perhaps that comes partly from our desire for a feeling of safety, that we like to think there's a kind of uncrossable distance almost between most of us and those that commit crimes.
Oh, absolutely. And we see it in the media all the time, don't we? In that people who commit crimes are described as monsters, they're described as evil, which makes them sound almost demonic, you know, not human. And we like to put people into their various boxes. I think that our brains are just designed for that, aren't we? We are, as human beings, categorical thinkers. But actually, the world that we live in isn't made of clear-cut, distinctive groups. We are categorical thinkers in a world of continuums. And I think that gets lost very often. And so the whole question of, is this person mad or bad, I just find so unhelpful. Maybe they are more one or the other, if you care to use those terms. Maybe they are both. Maybe they are neither. Maybe they are some shade of grey in between, and that is more often the case. But I think that we do it because, as you say, we want a sense of safety, and we want to feel that these people are not like us and not like people that we know. And if we do come across them in life, we are going to recognise them, because there's going to be something very distinctive and different about them. So it's easy to think about people who commit crime as monsters, and we think that they, you know, they're going to look strange, aren't they? There's going to be something about them. They're going to be that lone weirdo that's maybe lurking down a dark alley, which is absolute nonsense. And I learned very, very early on that the idea of them and us is really, it's an illusion. I worked at Wakefield Prison. It was my first job as a want-to-be forensic psychologist. So I'd taken on a voluntary role as an assistant, wasn't getting paid for it. And Wakefield Prison is a maximum security prison. So it was known as Monster Mansion in the media, still is known as Monster Mansion. I know. I was told, look, it's them and us. So the staff members and the inmates, two very, very distinct groups. You know, there are the good guys and the bad guys. Well, let me tell you, without going into too much detail, the big problems I had were not from the inmates, they were from the prison officers. And actually, 5 or 6 years after I left Wakefield Prison, the senior officer in charge of Sea Wing, where I did quite a lot of work, a man named John Hall, was arrested and given a life sentence, because on his way home from work in his prison officer's uniform, he'd actually been abducting women and girls. So the them and us distinction clearly didn't hold true. So it was a good lesson for me. It was a good lesson for me. So I always say there's no them and us, it's just us. And this is what we need to learn to live with.
Wow, but a tough one to learn, because particularly for me, of what you mentioned earlier, the idea that people want to think they can see who will be a threat. It makes me think how in reality then what might be scarier is not somebody that's dressed like the Joker, but instead somebody that we don't suspect. You know, somebody that doesn't have whatever we think the visual is based on movies. And, you know, we want to feel like we have some relative judge on when we are safe or not.
We want to feel that we've got some control, and we've got to feel that we operate in a safe world. A sense of safety is so fundamental, isn't it? And so many of the people that I work with that have got mental health problems, a lot of them stem from not having felt safe at some point in their life. So yes, and I think this is why people watch true crime films and read true crime books and true crime documentaries, which I take part in. I think it's because we want to feel that we are learning about crime and criminals, and that that will leave us equipped to not end up as victims. But it also feeds into an idea that if you are victimized, that you are somehow to blame for not spotting the signs and, you know, making yourself available. How many times have we heard that somebody, you know, went and got themselves attacked, or a woman got themselves raped? We talk about, we don't say men raped women, which is significant, isn't it?
And only recently in Minnesota, the law was tweaked, I'll say, because it wasn't hugely different to this in the first place, whereby rape can be essentially annulled if the woman was voluntarily drunk, I think is how it's phrased. So the idea is her rights go away if she chose to be drunk in some situations.
So if women drink too much alcohol, then it's basically a declaration that, hey, you can have sex with me. What nonsense. What absolute nonsense.
It's ridiculous. And that is the world we're living in. And so what you were saying about this idea of us and them, and that not being as clear as maybe some people like it to seem, would be scary to a lot of people. But it seems like you've managed to navigate that really well.
I hope so. And I think it's really important for me to start to show what I have learned working in the criminal justice system and working in the mental health system to a wider audience. Because I think that not only can we learn about crime and criminal behaviour, but we also learn about victims and the way that we view victims and the way that the legal system responds to people who have been victims and the way that the mental health system responds to that. So we learn about ourselves as a society, and I think that that's really, really important.
Yeah, well, I've heard you talk a lot about the idea of no crime happens in a void. You know, there's so many factors, not only in the life of the individual, but also the behaviour of those around them. And so we need to include that, but obviously not go so far as to say, well, you were in proximity of that person, and therefore that's why you're a victim.
Yeah, I think so. And I think we need to know the way that the law often discriminates against certain types of victims, and the way that the media will report on a certain type of victim. So, for example, not every murder of a woman is heavily reported in the media, but when one does really hit the headlines, that woman tends to be young, white, middle class, and living what we would consider an acceptable lifestyle. So what we see in the media is actually very, very skewed, and there are lots of very subtle beliefs and attitudes that underpin media stories that I think are important to start to call out. And where victimhood is concerned, I think that mental health problems are often survival strategies that have become out of control. I think how somebody actually labels their mental health problems is very much up to them. If it's useful for them to think, I am ill, fair enough. But I think that the danger is that we start to think of ourselves as having, oh, I've got this disorder or that disorder. So the word disorder suggests that there's something wrong with you. Yeah. Not necessarily that there's something wrong with what has happened to you in the past. So I think that it implies a blame, or it implies a dysfunction. And in actual fact, as I say, what we think of as symptoms of mental illness are often just exaggerated responses that other people experience. It's just that it's gone over that threshold where it's intolerable, or it's making yours or somebody else's life very, very difficult.
you know, that's one of the many reasons why mental health stigma baffles me, because so much of it, when you delve into it and when you seek therapy and other support, you can draw these lines of where your experiences today link to things you've been through, which, like you say, it's a lot of these things that happen to you that might be better labelled disordered.
I think that it makes people seem more frightening rather than packaging it as somebody's having an understandable response to whatever has happened to them, which doesn't have to be a massive thing. It might not even be something that they're necessarily aware of. It might be something that's happened very early on in their life. You know, their brain, of course, is responding to the experience that we have. It's not that it's just out of control for no reason whatsoever and can't be brought back into line. And I think that when we talk about illness and we talk about chemical imbalances and we make it very biological, I think that it actually increases mental health stigma. It increases fear, because it's just like that, you know, that thing that comes along and hits you, and suddenly no part of yourself remains. And with all of the people that I've worked with, and I've seen people that have had, you know, really extreme disturbances, they are still themselves, their core self still remains. They don't suddenly become an entirely different person. They can become somebody who is difficult to understand. They can become somebody who seems very different to the person that they once were. But I think, again, it's this feeling that they've been overtaken by something that I find problematic.
Yeah, this is what I guess comes from perhaps people's fears, that they want others to behave in a way that makes sense to them.
Yeah, exactly that, exactly that. They want them to make sense to them. They're not prepared to actually step into that other person's reality and try and understand it from their perspective. And we've got all of these ideas about how somebody ought to behave that really, I think, we often need to, within reason, abandon. But I think that particularly when it comes to stigma of mental health problems, I think that it's because we think that people with mental health problems are dangerous. And actually, all of the research shows that people with mental health problems who do commit violence, it's not necessarily a straight cause and effect between, you know, the mental health problem and the violence. There are other factors at play, which are exactly the same factors which predict violence in people who don't have diagnosable mental health problems.
Yes. And even further to that, we often have stats about how more common it is for people who experience mental ill health to be victims of crime. And yet, I think, like you say, we're encouraged to think in this way with the kind of media portrayals. And you've reminded me of one of the ones that annoys me the very most out of all is when so often you see a crime, and I think this is particularly when it's cases of violent crime, and the media are scratching around in writing their articles and whatever else to find out what happened, understandably, and what they can report. And it seems like mental illness is often treated as some kind of easy answer that it's clearly not. You know, how often do you see it where something's happened and then it mentions in the article, you know, a neighbour said they had been known to experience depression. And so there's this active police investigation. There's wonderful people like yourself trying to figure out what really went on. And then they've just found out, OK, there's a bit of mental illness that maybe a neighbour thinks they know about. And then that's the answer, tick.
And actually, it's incredibly common, isn't it, to have experienced a bit of depression. Or yeah, I've experienced a bit of depression, or maybe even quite a lot of depression at times. It doesn't make me dangerous. But this is it. We're always looking for the why. We want to know why. And sometimes the why is very, very complicated. In fact, it's always very, very complicated and nuanced. And I think that it's so easy, particularly these days where, you know, there's an expert that will step up at any moment. It's put out there as though, oh, right, that explains everything. That explains absolutely everything. No more questions need to be asked. You know, there we have it. So I just think that they're very lazy, simplistic, shorthand, not even explanations, really. And they're often used as excuses. Sometimes they're used in a way that might make somebody feel that they are, you know, written off for life. And what really upsets me is I constantly get people who send me messages on Twitter or social media, and they say to me, Kerry, I've just been diagnosed with some form of psychotic disorder, or I've been diagnosed with borderline personality disorder or emotionally unstable personality disorder. Does that mean the people that I love are in danger from me? People are genuinely frightened of this. And that is because of the messages that they pick up in the media.
It's scary to hear that, and I totally know it goes on, but to think that somebody's able to soak that up so much that it overrides their own knowledge of themselves, that they can know, I'm not a violent person, I would never do anything like that.
This is it. They've been told all of my character is going to be wiped out. All of my history is going to be overtaken by these faulty neurons that are firing. It is. It's genuinely frightening for people.
It's terrifying and really activates that internalized stigma as well, that then can, you know, be a thing that prevents you getting help, prevents you asking these questions to mental health professionals in the first place. And I often talk about how much I'd love to see more portrayals of mental illness where it's just something that has no bearing on the plot, where someone maybe has a pill every morning and it's acknowledged and there's nothing more about it, you know?
Exactly, and it's inconsequential. This is the thing, and this is what I struggled with, really, when I was writing my books. Because obviously I work in forensic psychology and I work quite often with a group who are called mentally disordered offenders. It's a horrible, you know, it's a horrible label, but that's what it is. So mentally disordered offenders, or MDOs. And so people, A, assume that, you know, the diagnosed mental disorder has directly caused the offending behaviour, which isn't true at all. There are lots of different relationships between mental disorder and offending. Quite often, the mental disorder can come after the offending. And also, there are certain diagnoses which, really, when you look at them, Munchausen syndrome by proxy, now known as factitious disorder by another. What is Munchausen's disorder by proxy other than medically harming another person? So it's actually a criminal behavior that has been repackaged and imagined as a mental health problem. Does that make sense?
No, so, absolutely. I've never even thought about it that way, but you're right.
There's a whole chapter of that in my book. So when I'm writing my books, I'm thinking, well, you know, I'm writing about these things, and I really don't want to be contributing to this false notion that people with mental health problems are dangerous. So I really need to write about them in a way that is honest and is nuanced and gives people the facts. So I think that we can tell these stories in a responsible way. But wouldn't it be lovely, as you say, to have stories about people who have mental health difficulties and actually they cause no problems whatsoever. They go to work, they live their lives, you know, they contribute to society. It's just that people don't want to read those stories. We only want the doom and gloom stories. and this is it. So I think you're right. We need to start hearing about the everyday experiences of people with not just anxiety and depression, which, you know, there are celebrities queuing up, aren't they, to talk about their experiences of anxiety and depression, which is fine. But why don't we ever get to hear about people or celebrities who suffer with hearing voices, for example? And why don't we hear about people who achieve things despite the fact that they're hearing voices? Or maybe, you know, they have found hearing voices a positive experience. We just don't get the full range of stories. We just get the doom and gloom stories.
It's so strange, isn't it? And I think there's that still hierarchy of stigma of certain conditions maybe seen that they might hurt a celebrity's career. And so I'm sure there's conversations that go on behind the scenes of, okay, don't talk about that one, but you can talk about the depression. And absolutely, it's so harmful. And I also was reminded of an example of one of my favourite artists, Yo-Yo Kusama, a Japanese artist who incorporates her hallucinations into her artwork. And so absolutely, there are so many people that thrive with a whole range of mental illnesses, and there are people that include that in their work in incredible ways. And where is that range of stories?
Exactly. We miss out, I think, so much on hearing about the real experiences of people. We divide people into normal people that we want to hear from and then mad and bad people that we only really want to hear from in a news report about something that's gone terribly wrong.
And you remind me of a term that I think will surely die out at some point, and that is the term neurotypical. In some ways, it can be quite useful if you want a shorthand to describe, like, you know, let's say a study into comparing a neurotypical response to a response of someone experiencing depression. But when you actually get into it, how could we ever define what's neurotypical, because we're all so different? How many people would even fit under that label? Because surely you'd have to take out so many different groups. How could you have that sort of, what is a ultimately impossible to perfectly measure term? So I wonder how long that one will last.
Where on the continuum do you become neurotypical or neuroatypical? I mean, it's very, very subjective, isn't it? But I know it's a strange thing. There's a story in my book about somebody who did eventually go on to have a diagnosis of Asperger's disorder. And he was immediately in the frame for yet another violent offence, because everybody around him thought that he was, you know, odd, a little bit strange. So again, that oddness, strangeness must equate to dangerousness thing happening. And he was actually one of my favourite ever people to work with and one of my favourite stories to write. He wasn't responsible for the offence that he was in the frame for, but he did have a particular, what you might call a specialist interest, and that was serial killers, which was not very helpful within the context what he was suspected of. But yeah, I think that there's such a beautiful, diverse range of human experience. And it's a shame that we can't just embrace that and allow people to be what they want to be and accept that there are positives and negatives to everything. And it's really how somebody makes sense of their own experience that should inform that.
Yeah, the more you get into some of this language, the more it seems like a shorthand. You know, I've just got thinking, even as you were talking there about, well, I don't count as neurotypical even before any mental illness diagnosis, because I've always had dyslexia. But then is that neurotypical for me, right? Because that's always been something that I've dealt with. So it's interesting to sort of explore with you how these things will develop. And in terms of your work then, you're working with a whole range of people, like you've already mentioned, victims of crimes, those that perpetrate those crimes as well. Some people where they're trying to distinguish what box of those somebody would fit under. And so what kind of questions are you commonly trying to answer with your clients? Is that primarily in terms of supporting them in figuring out what they've been through? Or is it, you know, people you're reporting back to on how much of a reliable witness they might be, things like this?
It's really varied, because I don't know whether you could say I've been incredibly lucky or just incredibly chaotic, in that I've worked in lots of different areas of forensic psychology. So I've worked in secure hospitals, but then I've also done expert witness work for the courts. I've worked in communities. I've worked with the police. So you're always given a set of questions. So the typical question is, how much of a risk is this person? But then sometimes you might be working therapeutically with somebody. And in forensic psychology, there's always that, you know, do you want to make somebody into a happy bunny or do you want to make them into a safe bunny? And I say, make them safe, and then they can work on the happy. So that sometimes is a question. And then often I'm asked to come into court and give an opinion on what was the mental state of this person at the time that they committed an offence. And of course, that is because we want to decide how culpable they were. And that is important. But again, the law works in such black and white. So are they culpable or are they not culpable? There are very few degrees within that. And I find that difficult. It tends to be, is that diagnosable condition even relevant to the offence? What should we do about it? I think that what I find is that what happens to you in court very much depends on your lawyer. So I'm not sure that justice gets served. And I see so many people in the prison service who have got really quite severe mental health problems, and they've maybe not had the hotshot lawyer, or maybe they've just not been treated sympathetically in court, because there's often a belief that people will try and, when they're accused of very serious offences. And that can happen, but it doesn't happen as often as people think. And so you get people in the prison service who have got terrible problems and they're not being addressed. And then you'll get people in mental health settings who actually don't have mental health problems that I would regard as particularly relevant to their offending or particularly problematic for them. So, you know, the disposals that we have, it, again, are very binary. There's just a huge, big mess, I think, in the criminal justice system.
And as we start to round up, I'm interested to hear about, with so many of the experiences you've come across through your work and the things that people tell you, what you do for your own mental health, how you offload, what kind of practices you have in place.
Yeah, I mean, I've definitely had times where my own mental health has suffered. But this is it. It's, as you said at the beginning, we divide people into, there are those who are ill and those who are not. Mm-hmm. And actually, I think people who might consider themselves ill are people who are at that moment in time struggling really to survive this thing that we call life more than others. And I think that, you know, our mental health is in a constant state of flux and change, dependent on a lot of things, the amount of pressures that we have, the amount of stress that we're under, things that happen to us as we go through life. And so that, yeah, there have definitely been times when I've struggled, and I've struggled as a result of things that I've seen at work, or I've been traumatized by things that I've seen at work. I definitely try to pace myself. I try to understand my own patterns, because we've all got very unique patterns, haven't we? And there are usually those early indicators that things are going a little bit awry. That balance is about to really skew. So for me, I tend to somatize stress, and I tend to feel physical symptoms before I get, you know, the mental health consequences. So I tend to, you know, I get dizzy, more physical manifestations of anxiety. So I try and really pay attention to my body, because it gives me such useful signals, and intervene, you know, that circuit breaker. What can I do to stop progressing to the next level? And those things might be just to take an hour in the day to go for a walk. I love walking my dogs. I love walking my dogs. There's a saying, time spent in nature is never wasted, or time spent amongst trees is never wasted. So that's my mindfulness activity, because I actually hate mindfulness. Drives me up the wall. I can't do it. You know, the hours that I've spent, you know, staring at a raisin or all of the things, it just doesn't work for me. But what does work for me is going out for a really nice walk with my dogs, somewhere nice and quiet. That's a good switch off for me. And if things are are getting to the point where I think that actually my mental health is starting to suffer, then it's a cliche, but talking and connecting with people. And so whether that's professionally, because obviously I can't talk about work-related things with my friends, but I can with supervisors and I can with colleagues. Sometimes I've done therapies, so I've had EMDR, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, you know, the eye movement therapy.
Yeah,
for traumatic things I've heard at work, and I found that really effective.
And so with that one specifically, was that to help sort of desensitize you again from some of the things you'd experienced, particularly those that weren't your first-hand experiences?
Well, I think that vicarious trauma is almost part and parcel of the job, because you hear so much horror. And I see a lot of horror, not firsthand, but I see it in crime scene photographs and videos. And also, sometimes what I find most horrific is the sheer scale of what goes on. So, you know, for example, there was a period of my life when I was working with sex offenders who were sexually abusing children and making images of that for sale or swapping on the internet. And I think that the realization of how big a scale of the problem that was, I found really very, very difficult. So I had to deal with it. And so, yeah, the same therapy that I had seen work really, really well for not only things like people who were suffering with post-traumatic stress, so maybe people in the military who had come back from war zones, but also a form of therapy that I'd seen work really, really well with people who had psychotic experiences. And that was clearly rooted in past trauma. So I had a psychologist who worked with me who was very, very good at EMDR, and she gave that to me. And that's one of the perks of the job, I suppose, is knowing where to go and of course not having to pay for it, because yeah, I mean that's one of the great inequalities, isn't it? Most people with mental health problems, unless they are prepared to pay for therapy, end up on a waiting list. So I think that, you know, I'm very grateful for the fact that I do know colleagues who are skilled in certain therapies and they're willing to give me that for free, because I realize many, many, many people don't have that and don't have access to therapy and help when they need it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's brilliant that you have that support. If I may ask one more personal question, when researching for this episode, I came across a lot of wonderful interviews that you'd given. And so often people would question why you got into this work. And that rubbed me up the wrong way a little bit, the idea that, you know, of course, this is such important work and it's fascinating and I can see why you find it to be so. But there was also often an additional undertone that annoyed me even more of, you seem like a nice woman, why would you go into this? And I think once or twice you rightly pointed out that actually 80% of the people in your field in the UK are women.
People always say to me, you don't look like a forensic psychologist, and why would a woman want to do this job? And I've even had people ask me, you know, have you worked with sex offenders because you get some sort of sexual kick from it? Because I can't understand why you'd want to do it otherwise. So you do get some really strange questions. I went into forensic psychology ultimately because, without wanting to sound like I'm a Miss World contestant and I want to give you this flattering answer, but I genuinely wanted to contribute to a better world and a world with less victims in it.
Yeah.
Although I suppose that my interest in forensic psychology happened almost by accident. So I was at Sheffield University, and I fully intended to go into a career in advertising. I fancied being an advertising executive. I wanted to write advertising jingles, believe it or not. And I think I'd seen on TV that this looked like a well-paid and quite glamorous profession. There was a very good looking boy in the law classes. And so when it came to what subsidiaries did I want to take, I made that life-changing decision. And of course I took law. And I never spoke to this man. Well, he wasn't a man at the time. He was a 18 or 19 year old, but I never spoke to him, never plucked up the courage to talk to him, but got into a love affair with the law, really. And the law and psychology, put them both together, what do you get? You get forensic psychology, and it is a fascinating area to work in. But more than that, it's a really rewarding area to work in. There's nothing better than seeing somebody discharged from a hospital and go and pick up the reins of their life. And there's nothing better than having optimism for somebody who has, yes, committed an offence, but is leaving to different circumstances and is going to turn their life around. And actually, there are far fewer opportunities for those great moments than I had envisaged when I started out in forensic psychology. I've been quite disillusioned by it in a lot of respects, but still, it is rewarding.
Yeah, well, no, that's really great to hear. And so we will wrap up then with you sharing a little bit about your new book, having already been a Sunday Times bestseller. You've come back with another book called What Lies Buried. Could you share a bit about that?
Well, the first thing that I'm going to say is it's nothing to do with pathology or dead bodies. People think that the title means that, you know. No, I'm a forensic psychologist, not a pathologist. Yeah. And actually, it's, again, a collection of case studies, if you like, but it's a collection of stories about the people that I've worked with. And I've written them because I want people to see my clients in the same way that I see them, as whole people with stories, great stories, which explain so much about who they are, what they have done, or maybe what they haven't done, but people assume that they might. And it's about, I suppose, what lies buried in people's psyches, if we care to look, and what lies buried in their histories, but also what lies buried in terms of the messages that we hear from the media about mental illness and stereotypes around that. And I hope that it challenges people's preconceptions. If it does, then I feel that I've done it right. I've got my job right. I want people to read it and go, I haven't thought about that. And I'm going to look at people in a more compassionate light as a result of it.
Brilliant. And from what I've read, I'm very confident it'll do just that. So, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Thank you. That makes me feel good. I hope so.
Definitely.
The take home is people with mental health difficulties are not, by definition, dangerous. So let's stop with that nonsense, please. Let's challenge it when we see it. Let's call out that bullshit.
For sure. Well, thank you so much for sharing and for all you do. It's been great chatting.
Thank you. Thank you for reading my book. Take care.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.